It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new term for the U.S. Supreme Court has experts expecting new legal precedents that could change the law of the land. We'll find out what that might mean for Wisconsin. But first, state lawmakers approved a plan last month to spend millions of dollars to combat the opioid epidemic in Wisconsin, and the funding's part of a national settlement with four companies accused of fueling the crisis. The state's share this year is about $31 million with funding for treatment and recovery facilities, tribal nations, and the overdose treatment drug Narcan. We're going to hear a few perspectives on this plan, starting with one of the Republican lawmakers who worked on the version that was ultimately approved. But we also want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. What do you want to see this opioid settlement money go to? How has opioid addiction touched your life or your family's? And where do you think funding could make the biggest difference now? 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas at WPR.org. Our guest, Mark Bourne, Republican representing the state's 39th Assembly District, which includes Beaver Dam. Also the co-chair of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee, Representative Bourne, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
If you would, please start by walking us through some of the things that you funded with this $31 million in settlement money.
Well, we knew that this is an important issue. It's something that the legislative Republicans have been working on for about a decade. And so we wanted to build on some of the successes of our HOPE agenda. We wanted to focus on a variety of areas in prevention and treatment and education, make sure that we were focused on specific programs that we knew could be successful and that would not take a lot of time to develop. Because especially with this first round of settlement money, we wanted to get some money into the communities more quickly and really start to address more of these issues. We know that drug use and overdoses have increased both during the pandemic and since then, and really wanted to make sure that we got some real bang for the buck, so to speak. And so whether it be expanding the Narcan Direct program, providing some funding for fentanyl strips, you know, to help directly with those overdoses, partnering with our K-12 partners, as well as groups like the Boys and Girls Club on education initiatives that are available to help, and putting more money into things like medication-assisted treatment, which we know has had good successes in communities as well as in jails, a variety of things. Those are a few of them, but mostly the focus was on trying to make sure that we went into programs that either existed or community partners that existed that we knew could be helpful in immediately trying to address this issue.
And Representative Bourne, you mentioned the overdose treatment drug Narcan. Could you tell us how the funding specifically for Narcan would be used?
There's a current program, and this plan puts another $3 million into that program to get Narcan more widely available in our communities. One of the things it prioritizes is law enforcement and first responders. That's something that was very important as we worked on our plan that was different than what the administration put forward. We know that our public safety partners, whether it be police, sheriff, fire, EMS, those are the boots on the ground in our communities. Those are the men and women that are on the front lines helping us in a variety of ways. And this situation with overdoses and combating opioids is certainly an area where they're on the front lines. And so the Narcan program is one where they can be immediately there to help save lives. And so it's a program we have, and this expands on it, uses some of these funds to expand on that.
Representative Mark Bourne, our guest, he is a co-chair of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee as they have approved the settlement spending for the settlement funds for this year and the opioid legal settlement money for Wisconsin. And if you have questions, 1-800-642-1234. But I have to ask you, Representative Bourne, if the $3 million for Narcan spending, additional spending, would be enough to make a meaningful difference across the state of Wisconsin?
Yeah, we think so. I mean, we think that we wanted to make sure we impacted things in a variety of areas, and so that's obviously one. But, yeah, I think that that'll have a meaningful impact, and certainly our community partners thought that and part of that discussion. And this is one area where we also agree with the Department of Health. Their funding was at the same level.
And Representative Bourne, funding for family support programs was taken out by the Joint Finance Committee. Why did they make that decision?
Yeah, like I mentioned, we wanted to work on programs that were already established or partners in our communities that already had established programs with this first round of funds. There will be additional settlement funds and additional plans in the coming years, and some of these new programs might rise to the top with those or with other funding. But we wanted to make sure that we had a more of an immediate impact and not just have bureaucrats in Madison creating new programs and spending months or years trying to develop a new program. So that was really the focus of partnering with, you know, groups like the Boys and Girls Club, our public safety partners, medication-assisted treatment partners, providers throughout the state, organizations like Meda House in the Milwaukee area. There are a lot of partners out there already, both public and private sector, that are doing great work in this area, and we felt it made more sense to focus this first round of settlement money on those type of programs and not spend months or years developing the new programs right now.
Let's go to Philomena now over the phone at 1-800-642-1234. She's in Bad River. And Philomena, you're on the air with Representative Mark Bourne.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. So the Bad River community has had an active harm reduction program in place for the last 8 years. And our focus with Narcan procurement and provision has been with people who use drugs. This has resulted in thousands of overdose reversals, many, many more than what have been accomplished by law enforcement officers. So, you know, I'm hoping that the legislature, the Joint Finance Committee,
Oh, I think we lost you, Philomena, and I apologize.
Opioid settlement.
We lost you there for a second, but Representative Bourne, with the time we have, is there money set aside for our native tribes in Wisconsin in dealing with the opioid addiction?
Definitely. They would both be, since she was specifically looking at Narcan, that would be available in that. But also there's $6 million targeted specifically to the tribal nations, and something that certainly they could develop those programs with those funds as well.
Representative Bourne, you've got a background with the Dodge County Sheriff's Office, as I understand it. And from a law enforcement perspective, what do we do about addiction? Narcan saves lives, but what do we do to end the cycle of addiction? And what role do you see law enforcement playing in that?
I think they play a major role, and that's why we prioritize grant funding for law enforcement when the Evers administration targeted them for $0 in this, because we know that those are the folks in our communities right there that can help. And I think too often people think of law enforcement as only the arrest or the enforcing the, you know, the crime part of it. And instead, they're usually parts of the education program and the prevention programs. And if I think about in my community, all of the places where you can dispose of your narcotics that you don't need anymore at home are in sheriff's departments and police departments. They're not something that you find at a state building or at a human services building, because these law enforcement and public safety folks are all over our state. So there are logical places to be helpful. Another one is the sheriff's department, which, as you mentioned, I used to work for years ago. I worked in the jail. The medication-assisted treatment in the jail is a huge thing. We're having success with that in Dodge County, and I know in counties throughout Wisconsin, and some of those grant funds could be used to expand those programs and help people get off of these drugs and when they get out, not get back on them and be productive members of society. Those are huge opportunities for a variety of problems in our system.
Representative Bourne, thanks for being with us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
State Representative Mark Bourne of Beaver Dam with us today to talk about the Republican written plan to spend millions of dollars in opioid settlement funds. That plan was approved by the legislature's Joint Finance Committee last month. Now up next, we'll hear more perspectives on the plan from the head of an addiction advocacy group in Beloit and an expert on the opioid epidemic. And you can join in as well at 1-800-642-1234. Is opioid addiction something you've experienced or someone in your life has? And what resources helped you? How do you beat the cycle of addiction? 1-800-642-1234. Sharing your story may help others. Email us if you wish. ideas@wpr.org. Our conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our conversation about a plan that state lawmakers recently passed to spend millions of dollars in opioid settlement money to deal with the addiction across the state. And we'd like to hear your story at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our next guest, Tracy Burtis, is the founder and president of the Bloit Advocacy Group, Families Fighting Addiction. Tracy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Also joining us, Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury Afshar, specializing in opioid addiction medicine and public health at UW Health. Dr. Salisbury Afshar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm going to start with you, Doctor. Does the spending plan passed by the state legislature fund the kinds of things that Wisconsin needs to make a difference in this opioid epidemic?
That's a great question, and I think one that can be hard to answer because sadly there's so much work that we still have to do. I was in many ways pleased to see that they were thinking broadly in terms of covering prevention, treatment services, recovery supports, and harm reduction services. At this early stage, I think so much of the devil's in the details, as they say, in terms of how things are implemented, how we are strategically considering which communities have been impacted, and finally, really ensuring that community has voice and how these funds are being distributed and spent, and making sure that we have key players, particularly people with lived experience themselves, as well as families and friends of those individuals at the table as we're thinking about implementation across these various areas.
And Tracy Burtis, you've had this lived experience. You lost your son 5 years ago to an overdose. You yourself are a nurse, and you thought, you save people for a living so you could save your son. As you look now at what's ahead for dealing with the opioid epidemic in Wisconsin, funding for you're working on this issue on the ground. So what to you is the most important funding need when it comes to the opioid epidemic, Tracy?
Well, I agree with Dr. Afshar. There's so many different things that have to be done. We are behind the eight ball here because there's so many deaths. So we can't just start with prevention. We're going to have to hit everything all at once. And it's my opinion that we need to first stop the deaths and then start from the beginning, because we are really, really quite far behind in all of this.
And Dr. Salisbury Afshar, how important is funding for Narcan in this fight just to keep people alive?
I think continuing to fund naloxone I use the term naloxone because that's the generic name, but same thing as Narcan, is really critical. But I would just sort of double down on what the previous caller stated, which is that available evidence really supports that the people most likely to save someone's life are people who use drugs themselves. We know that they are likely to be around other people who use drugs. We know that they are really, really resourceful and really adept at knowing how to support their community. For my clinical practice, I solely work with people who use substances. And I know firsthand that a lot of people are really afraid to call 911 because of the potential legal repercussions. And so that's not to say that I don't think police or paramedics or others should have access to naloxone, but in terms of prioritization, all available literature would support that people who use drugs should be the first priority in terms of ensuring access.
Mm. And Tracy Burtis has mentioned you've been in this position. Can you share a little bit about what it's like for families with a loved one struggling with addiction?
Sure. There's nothing worse than feeling completely powerless to help those that you love, a life you love more than your own. And you're unable because you don't have the tools available to save them. It's horrifying for any parent and any loved one to endure that.
And was there concerns about bringing in law enforcement into the equation? Was there fears that this might not be the helpful way to go? I mean, how did you decide what to do, where to go, and who to turn to?
Well, back 5 years ago, there wasn't anywhere to go or anybody to turn to. But I hear every day, all the time, we just recently lost another one where they had started CPR and then left. And by the time EMS got there, the young gal had brain damage and died on the way to the hospital. So it's happening all the time. And I think the more people that have the Narcan, the tools that they need to save the lives, if they have that available, the better. And that means everybody.
Tracy Burtis is the founder and president of the Beloit advocacy group Families Fighting Addiction. Also joining us, Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury Afshar, specializing in opioid addiction medicine and public health at UW Health. And we'll take your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Lisa in Amberg standing by. Lisa, you're on Central Time.
Yes, I used to be a nurse, and I have a pet peeve. I went through training as a nurse in the 80s when the pharmaceutical companies were convincing the doctors that you couldn't over-medicate for pain, that if a person had pain, that they would not become addicted. I specifically remember being taught that. And you have a whole generation of doctors that went through that school that may or may not be on the eight ball, so to speak. But a pet peeve I have is that we acknowledge that the pharmaceutical companies created the majority of this problem.
That's where the money came from.
The people, right? But most of the people that are victims, we acknowledge that they are victims of the pharmaceutical company, but we criminalize them. We arrest them. We put them in jail. Then they have a record, and it's even more difficult for them to function in society, to be able to find a way out. And what upsets me is we claim that we don't have the money to take care of this problem, or there's not enough money to take care of this problem. And I'm not suggesting at all defunding the police. I don't mean it that way at all. But if we put some of the money that they're spending in housing and arresting these people and feeding them in jail and made more beds available for treatment, it would help a lot more than arresting people.
Lisa, thank you so much for your perspective. Dr. Salisbury Afshar, are we doing any law enforcement assisted diversion, this community based diversion approach, which takes people who would be considered low level drug or criminals and takes them into a process of beginning the treatment and recovery from addiction? Do we see that in Wisconsin?
I am not in the best position to be able to answer across the entire state regarding what is or what isn't happening as it relates to diversion and deflection. But I would just like to go back to something that was just said. And I think just say, you know, again, in working with people with addiction, this is something that I see all the time. While folks are active in their addiction, many end up getting some type of charges, often charges for sort of very small amounts of possession of substances. Sometimes people even end up, their sole charges are related to surviving an overdose. So because they have a small amount of substance or they have substance paraphernalia on them at the time of their overdose, they end up with these charges that stay with them for the rest of their lives. That then makes it harder for them to get jobs. It makes it harder for them to get housing. If they have children, it makes it harder for them to maintain custody of their kids. And it really does sort of box people into a corner in terms of future opportunities. And so, you know, again, my space is more in the sort of healthcare treatment, recovery services, harm reduction space. So I don't want to say as a blanket that this never happens anywhere in the state. But I do think it's really important to acknowledge that science and medicine really support the idea that we should be doing everything we can to support folks, and the idea that you know, simply locking people up is going to somehow help them. We don't see that play out in the evidence, and I also don't see it play out in my clinical settings. And so I think anything we can do to really try to work with folks with addiction to ensure that they have the right services and opportunities to be able to, you know, find a new path is where we should be focusing.
And Tracy Burtis, you advocate for something called a Good Samaritan law in Wisconsin. Tell us about it and what chance you might think it has of becoming a law in the state.
Well, it's something I've prayed for years, and they're still working on it, apparently. And basically, it's a blanket law that anybody that is attempting to save a life because of an overdose, and if they call the 911 and get help for that person, which is necessary, that they will not be held accountable and will not have to even answer questions about the drug use, whether or not they gave the drug to the person that overdosed, whether they have any, if they have maybe they're on probation or parole. You know, none of those questions will be asked because, doggone it, they're trying to help save a life. And that's what you're looking at, is just that with that law.
Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury Afshar, I'm making you a co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee in the Wisconsin Legislature. And so now you have the purse strings here for the next round of funding for dealing with the opioid epidemic in Wisconsin. Where would you put that money? What's your priority?
I love the idea of having the purse strings. I think that the challenge in this space is that, the goal should be that these funds are used to augment and supplement where other sources of funding are already going. And I will not pretend that I have that broad understanding. I will say in my work, there are a few areas that I see where we have major gaps, and I am not aware of any funding going to these areas, either through this settlement fund or through other existing funds. Specifically, one is really recovery housing. So I know that, supports for residential or something that we're in here, but we see so many folks who, even if they can get access to residential treatment, when they leave residential treatment, they have nowhere to go. And going back to the streets or going back into their previous environment is really problematic. There are a lot of other things we could do on the recovery support side as it relates to job training, job placement programs. Additionally, although we're putting a lot more money toward treatment services, it doesn't mean that we automatically have enough clinicians in this space. And so really ensuring that we have a pipeline for substance use counselors, for peer recovery coaches, for all types of addiction treatment professionals, to be able to train people, recruit and retrain individuals, and ideally individuals who represent the communities they're serving. So those are just a few of the areas. And then the final thing I would say on this note is that, as Tracy mentioned, there is an absolute crisis at this time, and we need to simultaneously be thinking about everything, including prevention to treatment, recovery, and harm reduction. And on the prevention side, we understand that living in poverty, we understand that lack of housing, we understand that lack of educational opportunities, we understand that co-occurring mental illness, all of these things increase risk for the development of addiction. This needs to be a multi-sectoral approach. We can't expect opioid settlement money to quote unquote fix everything. It has to be something where we're all coming together and thinking holistically about the services and supports that people need, both to prevent the development of addiction in the first place, but also to support people who have addiction and or are recovering from addiction.
Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury Afshar, thank you so much for joining us. Also, Tracy Burtis, our guest this afternoon, taking a look at the opioid settlement funds available in Wisconsin and where best to put them. Conversation continues. You can always email us ideas@wpr.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and coming up, we take a look at the U.S. Supreme Court's new session, which opened yesterday, and the cases the justices will be deciding on. Now, when Roe v. Wade was struck down by the court over the summer, virtually all legal abortion in Wisconsin stopped, and this prompted one listener to ask WPR's Why Wisconsin, what resources exist for pregnant people? As Bridget Bowden reports, there are nonprofit organizations across the state, but some experts say they aren't adequate in helping vulnerable people during and after a pregnancy.
Babies and Beyond in Madison is open 3 days a week, giving out diapers, formula, food, clothing, and other goods to parents and expecting parents in need.
So what size diapers do you need?
Can I get size 4?
Alyssa Dunsell has 3 young children and an adopted teenager. On this day in late September, she's at the diaper bank for pull-ups and diapers for her 2 youngest and some clothes. According to the National Diaper Bank Network, 1 month of diapers for a single child costs about $80. Dunsell says her rent has gone up a lot in the last few years, too, making resources like this vital for her.
When you're living dollar to dollar, it's not paycheck to paycheck, it's literally dollar to dollar, all those little things add up.
Babies and Beyond Executive Director Brenda Collins says they've seen more and more people in need through the pandemic. Now they're serving more than 500 clients each month. And she expects to see that number continue to grow due to Roe v. Wade being overturned and most legal abortion services in Wisconsin ending.
I think naturally that's the way it's going to go, yes.
Collins calls Babies and Beyond a pro-birth organization. It's part of a network of groups commonly referred to as crisis pregnancy centers or pregnancy resource centers. You can find it listed on websites like Choose Life Wisconsin and Wisconsin Right to Life. The services offered by these centers vary greatly. Some do ultrasounds, pregnancy testing, or counseling. Colin says Babies and Beyond focuses on material needs like diapers and clothing. What they all have in common is their opposition to abortion. Although Babies and Beyond is not affiliated with any religious groups, many other pregnancy centers are, like Access Women's Center in Madison, which is affiliated with the Baptist Church.
We perform pregnancy tests, and we also provide a parenting support program.
That's the organization's director, Stephanie, who declined to share her last name because of concern for her safety. She says even before the fall of Roe, the center would not refer people for abortions. That means they'd say abortion was an option, but they wouldn't explain things like where you could get one, how to make an appointment, or how much it would cost.
People have phones. They can Google. I mean, it's at their fingertips if they really want it. But no, we don't refer for that. But we will gladly talk to them. Again, it's their choice.
Katrina Kimport studies crisis pregnancy centers at the University of California, San Francisco. She says historically, their first objective has been to convince people to not have abortions. And she says crisis pregnancy centers have been known to spread information that goes against science, such as the idea that having an abortion causes mental health issues.
When we think about these locations as really sites within an anti-abortion movement and really informed by an anti-abortion ideology, they have been a very successful source of misinformation around abortion.
Most of the people Kimport interviewed for her 2020 study had already decided not to end their pregnancies before going to the centers, and most of them reported having a positive experience. But she says nonprofit pregnancy centers are not a substitute for a social safety net. Regardless of the legal status of abortion, pregnant people and parents of young children need resources like healthcare and childcare.
The simple answer is it's not adequate. But it's not adequate just for people who may be considering abortion or maybe seeking an abortion. It's not adequate for pregnant people who have basic resource needs and families of young children.
Although they're not performing abortions, Planned Parenthood's Wisconsin clinics are still open and providing other services like STD testing and birth control. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, the Supreme Court of the United States started its new term yesterday, and many are waiting in anticipation for the possibility of new legal precedents that could change the direction of the country. Following the court's decisions this past summer to overturn Roe v. Wade, expand gun rights and religious protections, many speculate the court will continue its conservative trend. And others of the many of the cases concern affirmative action, including cases regarding race, LGBTQ rights, religious freedoms, and education. What are your expectations of the U.S. Supreme Court this term? 1-800-642-1234. What are you watching for? What cases are you interested in most? That's 1-800-642-1234 to join us and our guest, Charlie Jacobs, professor of political science at St. Norbert College, specializing in public law, judicial process, and American politics. Charlie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Lee.
Let's start with the oral arguments that the Supreme Court heard today. That was in regards to an Alabama redistricting case that is challenging the Voting Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination in voting. The case is called Merrill v. Milligan. How does race play a role in this case, Charlie?
Well, this is a challenge to Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And it also bears on some of the issues related to the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause. And what we're dealing with here is the often contentious process of redistricting. And in Alabama, which has a large percentage of its population that is Black, about 27% of the seven districts that were drawn for the U.S. House of Representatives, only one was created in such a way that you have a majority of minority voters. That is, a majority of the population in that district is made up of Black voters, and it's about 60%. But the argument here is whether or not there's a violation in particular of that Section 2, because there's a strong possibility that you could rather easily create a second district that would be a majority of Black voters, giving them an additional opportunity to elect somebody who has sort of similar backgrounds, similar lived experience, where they could vote for somebody who would best represent their interests in Congress. And so what we're dealing with here is this sort of tug of war that we've been seeing in the court for the last 15 years or so. And it's in many ways been prompted by some of the positions taken by Chief Justice Roberts regarding regarding the validity of the Voting Rights Act and how well it can be sustained sort of in modern America. So it was an interesting argument today in large part because our newest justice, Ketanji Brown Jackson, who herself is Black, is on the court and I think was really pushing hard for Alabama to explain its justification for the maps that it drew.
And how has the Supreme Court, at least most previously, voted on the Voting Rights Act?
Well, it's been sort of an interesting 60 or so years that we've watched this develop. They were actually rather limited in their view of the way in which it could protect Black voting rights through the late 1970s. And in fact, in 1982, Congress had to step in and they had to amend the act to try to create more opportunities to defend against what many believed were discriminatory acts by states in leaving out minority populations from sort of the kind of access to the ballot and the kind of choice that they wanted. So in 1982, what Congress added was that you did not have to show intent to discriminate on behalf of those in the state legislature who were responsible for drawing the maps. And that was quite a significant change legislatively, because now you just had to show through what's called a totality of the circumstances test, kind of pile all the evidence in a big heap to demonstrate that this was going to have an effect on the voting rights of Blacks. And this would help sustain their equal protection under law, as well as their access to the ballot. And since that time, the court has basically upheld the idea that, you know, you don't have to show intent and that there is the possibility of litigants to demonstrate that their voting rights have been harmed. What we're seeing now, in particular with these conservatives, is they're reading very, very narrowly the extent of this particular act. And the other thing that is disconcerting to groups like the NAACP and other voting rights activists is that they're making a claim that if you drew a second district in a place like Alabama, that would assist Blacks, that it's actually discriminating against whites. And that's a violation of the 14th Amendment clause, 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause. And for some on the court, that's kind of like bizarro world, tipping the 14th Amendment on its head.
Charlie Jacobs, our guest, professor of political science at St. Norbert College. And Charlie, this isn't the only case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court this term that could reshape our federal elections. There's also Moore v. Harper, which looks at the potential of reshaping our elections. How would that happen?
So it's interesting, although there are two different issues at stake here, they're kind of interlocked, because the outcome of each of these cases, if they were advantageous in the case of Moore versus Harper, which has to do with redistricting as well, if that accrued benefits to those who are promoting a particular theory known as the independent state legislature theory, and Alabama won, we could see a real impact on the way in which these districts get drawn, and likely to the disadvantage of those outside of power, like Blacks and minority political groups. So at stake in this particular case is an interesting reading of a particular clause in the federal constitution, Article 1, Section 4, which has to do with the time, place, and manner of elections, which is granted to states. So they get to tell you, you know, when elections take place, where they're going to take place, and the manner in which they're going to take place. So all of those kinds of ballot issues and when the polls are open, that's all left to the states. But their reading is really narrow. And what they're saying is this was handed to the legislature, which means state courts can't review the way legislatures define these kinds of issues.
Oh.
And the governor doesn't have the power to overturn decisions by that same legislature. So in essence, the constitution of the state isn't controlling, and the governor and the state courts have almost no control. Now, this particular theory was first kind of floated by Justice Rehnquist way back in 2000, the case that anybody...
Bush v. Gore?
Bush v. Gore. Yeah. Bush v. Gore is kind of the genesis of so many things we talk about today. But the argument there, if we recall the incidents, was that the state Supreme Court in Florida could not override decisions made by the state legislature about things like recounting ballots in that contested election. Now, it kind of sat dormant for a long time But since about 2015, and in particular since 2020, with the contested election with Donald Trump, we've seen this resurrected. Because if you pair this with some of the clauses in the Constitution about presidential electors and who gets to choose them, this would significantly narrow the ability of anyone outside of the state legislature to affect the outcomes of particular elections in particular ways. And it could, in the minds of some, lead to the stealing of elections by legislatures that were unhappy with what the polls were showing. So, you know, it's a complicated case, but one that has real legs when it comes to what's going to happen in 2022 and possibly 2024.
And certainly some ramifications for the state of Wisconsin and Wisconsin voters.
Correct, especially since, you know, we're talking about disbanding the Wisconsin
Elections Commission.
Commission and the effect that that will have. Mm-hmm. Even the investigations that we saw former Justice Gableman conducting regarding what they consider to be improprieties in the last election, all of these are kind of signals that Wisconsin might adopt this sort of independent state legislature theory to try and shut out the state courts and shut out the governor and possibly even neuter whatever clauses in the state constitution might regulate elections.
Charlie Jacobs, professor of political science at St. Norbert College, about some of the cases waiting for a vote from the Supreme Court. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Are these cases ones you're personally interested in? You think the Supreme Court will push the U.S. too much to the right or not enough yet? What questions do you have for Charlie Jacobs this afternoon about the decisions in front of our Supreme Court justices? 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue our conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn. And right now we're picking up our talk with Charlie Jacobs, professor of political science at St. Norbert College. And we're talking about some of the new cases approaching the Supreme Court that deal with affirmative action, LGBTQ rights, religious freedoms, and race. And if you've got a question or a comment, 1-800-642-1234. But Charlie, another big topic for the Supreme Court justices this term is affirmative action, specifically in education, challenging if colleges can use race as a factor in college admissions. And you mentioned before about the potential of the majority of Supreme Court justices deciding in this term about discrimination in voting rights for white people. And is there a case being made now in front of the Supreme Court about discrimination against white people in college admissions?
Not just whites. In fact, one of the cases that's coming to the court was prompted by some concerns raised by Asian Americans who believed that they were being shut out, in particular of Harvard, because of what they perceive as race-based selection for admission to that institution, suggesting that there were a number of qualified individuals who were being overlooked, in fact, sort of reverse discrimination to make sure that other classes of individuals, and it may be black or people from other racial or ethnic backgrounds or whites actually, were being sort of neglected. So they wanted to balance their class. But there are two separate cases coming to the court this term that originally were going to be argued together, but they've separated them in part because our newest justice, Ketanji Brown Jackson, had to recuse herself, that is, step away from the Harvard case because she had been serving on a particular committee with them and was not comfortable listening and ruling on that case. But both of them are suggesting an argument which has been percolating since at least the 1970s, when affirmative action was really being used widely by schools around the country, that there was an issue related to schools using race as one of many factors related to the admission standards. So the original case we often look to is one that was decided by the court in 1978 called Regents of the University of California versus Bakke, or for shorthand, the Bakke case. And what was happening was, is California was using firm quotas, trying to give a certain number of slots at their medical school to people from diverse backgrounds, blacks, so that they could, you know, serve their own communities be better connected to the healthcare of those individuals. And the court said, can't use quotas. That's out. But in a plurality decision, the court agreed that, yep, as one of many, many factors, you could use race as sort of a breakpoint, right? So you had two equal candidates, and one might be black and one might be white. And because you're trying to create better opportunities for blacks, you admit that person instead of the white. This was again relitigated in the early 2000s in a pair of cases, one called Grutter v. Bollinger and one called Gratz v. Bollinger. And the undergraduate admission process in that case for Michigan, University of Michigan, used something that looked quite a bit like a quota. They were assigning points to people with diverse backgrounds. The other one, which was the law school from University of Michigan, was only using race as a factor. And in that case, the court said, we still uphold the idea that race as a factor should be permissible, but quotas shouldn't. I think one of the telling lines from that particular case came from Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who said, the real hope is that in 25 years, we will have gotten to a point where we won't even need to discuss this because race won't be an issue anymore. Of course, the clock is ticking. We're only about 3 years or 5 years away from that marker that she had. And so the question is can you still use race as one of the many factors? Like, can you play a sport? Can you play a musical instrument? Do you have some attribute the school wants to have there to create a diverse student body from which everybody can learn? So I learn from my friend who is Latina, and I can learn from my friend who's Black or from a higher or lower socioeconomic status. And those are the kinds of variables that schools often use. And what these two litigants are trying to do here is say that we should be basically a meritocracy. Just look at the firm kinds of data that would suggest you deserve admission and admit those people no matter what their race or background is.
Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College. And Charlie, another case, and so much of this seems to be who's discriminating and who's being discriminated against, like the case that the Supreme Court is will be hearing oral arguments regarding the web designer in Colorado who says that serving same-sex couples goes against her religious rights as a Christian. But this isn't about religious freedoms, as I understand it. This is about freedom of expression.
Yeah, this is going to be a First Amendment free speech case, and whether or not she can express herself in this particular manner to defend herself about what she might have to promote in this particular case. I think part of this might have to do with some of the limited ways in which the court framed the most recent case on this issue related to religion. And I think some hesitancy by the court about how far you can go to allow individuals to express their religious freedom by denying people sort of public access to public goods, like getting photographs taken or having a cake baked for your wedding. And here she is making the argument that this is, in essence, the state forcing a particular owner of a business to express a particular idea and thought, which is sort of like putting words in that person's mouth as they articulate that issue. So, you know, these are issues that come up quite a bit, such as whether or not a state is required to put something on a license plate, or whether or not they can force doctors to tell patients particular things, say about abortion. And so this is just a different avenue by which to try and limit what the state can require private businesses to do as they interact with their customers.
And briefly, Charlie Jacobs, where do you expect we will find ourselves at the end of this term of the U.S. Supreme Court? What precedents would you see, perhaps by a 6-3 majority?
Well, on the first cases that we were talking about, my strong suspicion is that we're going to see some restrictions on the way in which these anti-discrimination laws are being applied to these classes of individuals. I mean, I think a phrase that has always resonated in my ear was from Chief Justice Roberts in a case called Parents Involved in Community Schools versus the Seattle School District from 2005. And in that case, he clearly said the way to stop discriminating based on race is to stop discriminating based on race. And so his argument basically was, you can't say that it's okay to discriminate against whites to achieve something for Blacks. He wants basically race neutrality everywhere. Now, that I don't think means that we're going to see the independent state legislative theory come to the fore, but I do think that we're going to see some restrictions in that way. I think that the legitimacy of the court is always in question, but they seem to have ridden it out this summer. And my suspicion is that after last term, the conservatives are going to be emboldened, and we're going to see them stretching the boundaries of precedent, the boundaries of constitutional and legislative interpretation in a way that's going to benefit those on the right side of the ideological aisle.
Charlie Jacobs, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Charlie Jacobs, professor of political science at St. Norbert's College, specializing in public law, judicial process, and American politics, taking a look at the now open term for the U.S. Supreme Court, the cases in front of them, and the precedents that may be forthcoming in the weeks and months to come. We will continue to follow this, but if you have a take on it, we welcome it at any time. You can always email us, ideas@WPR.org. We're up on the Facebook. You will find us there, and you can comment and let us know what you think and where will you see us going as a country, as a state, as a community. And again, that email address is ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow morning on The Morning Show, a shocking rise in sexually transmitted diseases. And you're going to hear from Wisconsin health leaders on what's changed in STD prevention since the pandemic. Also, an exclusive preview of the ninth season of Wisconsin Life on PBS. Angela Fitzgerald will join Kate Archer Kent tomorrow on The Morning Show. And that's tomorrow morning from 7 to 9, weekdays from 7 to 9, right here on the Ideas Network. Ohio police arrest and prosecute man who made fun of them on Facebook. Now, that may sound like a headline ripped from the satirical newspaper The Onion, but it's true. The Onion petitions the Supreme Court to protect parody. Also not a satirical headline. A Parma, Ohio man was put in jail for a Facebook page mocking the cops. The man sued the city of Parma, but an appeals court found that the police were protected by qualified immunity. Now that man's appealing all the way to the Supreme Court, and The Onion has filed a 23-page amicus brief on his behalf. Founded in Madison, Wisconsin in the late 80s, The Onion argues that their business model is being threatened, concluding, quote, "We'll continue to bring the disinfectant of sunlight into the halls of power, preferably not measured out in 15-minute increments in an exercise yard." Put in jail for poking fun at the government. That's not a headline from The Onion. That's America. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret today, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.